For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
For those who've not been here before, I'm Tygon Layton, the teacher at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. Welcome. And I'm very happy to have with us tonight Colleen Bush to talk about her book, Fire Monks. Really a wonderful read. It's so hard to put it down. There will be some copies of the book available for sale after the talk. And just to say briefly, Colleen's from the Berkeley Zen Center, and this book is about, it's really our home monastery, the monastery of the San Francisco Zen Center. A couple of us have practiced there. I was there for a few years in the early 80s, and Shiseo in 1990, and it's been a long time since I've lived there, but it's deeply imprinted. So 4 years ago, when it was threatened, it was powerful, and some of us were chanting as the fire was happening. Anyway, Colleen will tell you the story, but very dramatic story of what happened 4 years ago this month. So thank you very much for coming, Colleen.
Thank you for having me. So, I wanted to start with a little bit of gratitude. It's always a gift to think about this story and talk about this story with people. I always feel this sort of warm feeling inside, and so I want to thank Tygon for inviting me to come when I contacted him. And I also want to thank all my teachers who've been my teachers, and in particular Sojin Mel Weitzman, who's my teacher at the Berkeley Zen Center. So my husband and I, John, my husband John is here with me sitting back there, and we left Berkeley very early this morning. 4:30 was the alarm, to be exact. And when we got to the airport, John said, "Wow, all these people could have gotten up for Zazen." Because it was startling how many people were at the airport already at, you know, whatever it was by the time we got there, I guess 5:30, 5:45. And the line was snaking all around. It was like the biggest line I've ever seen, you know? And I thought, when he said that, I had a moment of imagining everybody actually sitting in Zazen, all those people. And I thought, wow, you know, what energy there would be, you know, if all these people, instead of, you know, chattering and scattering off to their own destinations and being on their phones, were sitting Zazen. And I think I'm pointing at that power in Fire Monks. So while I'm talking, I'm actually going to, at Tygon's suggestion, I'm going to pass a copy of the book around just so that you can glance through at some of the photos. Just if you haven't seen Tassajara, it will give you a little bit more of a visual to go with my words. So I'll do that in just a couple of minutes. I want to say a few things first. So obviously I'm going to talk to you about fire. And actually it's interesting that we make a distinction between wildfire. We have a word wildfire versus what? Domesticated fire? Tame fire? I don't know. You know, I'm looking at the candle over there. You know, is that wildfire? Is that fire that we have control of? I'm not sure there's such a thing as a fire that's actually not wild, if you really think about it. If I took that candle and I put it up next to a synthetic fiber, it would get wild pretty quickly. So wildfires have actually been in the news a lot this summer already out in the West. I don't know how much that registers in Chicago right now, but you know, you're feeling some heat here of a different kind. And in the summer of 2008, they were really in the news in California because the state actually was on fire. It wasn't just Tassajara, it was like the state of California was on fire because there had been these lightning storms that had started fires from pretty much one end of California to the other. Yeah, there had been 3 years of drought before this, that particular summer, which made everything nice and dry and ready to burn. And when these lightning strikes happened, the colloquial nickname for it after was the fire siege, or the lightning siege. Tassajara got caught in between a couple fires. Actually, it was caught between one that had started a few weeks earlier from an abandoned campfire, so just a little bit of negligence had turned into a very large fire. And then to the north of it was one of these lightning strikes, which immediately grew and became a sizable threat. So just a little background on Tassajara. I mean, can I get a show of hands for people who've actually been there? Okay, great. So I get the great pleasure of introducing Tassajara to those of you who haven't been here, there, and to those of you who have, maybe, you know, reminding you of it and what you cherish about it. So I'm going to pass the book around now, and there's a really nice photo section in the center, and please do two things at once, which we're not supposed to do in Zen, and glance at the pictures while I'm talking. So a little bit about Tassajara. It's really, as Taigan said, sort of the home temple for Soto Zen practice in America. It has a couple of distinct sort of personalities or forms, and one of those is to be a monastic training temple. So people can go there and leave everything else behind for a number of months and do intensive Zen practice. Wake up even earlier than 4:30. And people can go there in the summertime just to be a guest and just to be in this incredibly beautiful and serene wilderness area in this valley that is far from anything, where there's no cell phones and no traffic noises and no email. And they can relax at the hot springs, which have been in use for much longer than it's been a Zen temple. The Esalen Indians used to go there for the healing waters. And they go just to eat the food that a lot of people know Tassajara just because of the cookbooks that have been published over the years. The Tassajara Bread Book, Tassajara Cooking. So people go for all kinds of different reasons and have all kinds of different relationships with Tassajara. Some are not even Zen students, but they've been going for summers, for years. This is the place where they tap into some sort of inner quiet in themselves. One very essential feature about Tassajara is how it's reached. So one must travel over a 14-mile dirt road that Chinese laborers created with their backbreaking work. And it's not a road for the faint of heart. It goes down from a ridge that's around 5,000 feet, and Tassajara is at about 1,500 feet. So either climbing up it or going down it, it's quite an adventure, and you want a good vehicle. And it can get narrow, and it can be precipitously steep on one side or the other. It's a very dramatic road. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on. And just to say where Tassajara is, if you're familiar at all with California, with where Big Sur is on the coastline, basically just head straight inland about 10 miles, and that's where Tassajara is. It's in a very rugged wilderness area called the Ventana in the Santa Lucia Mountains. It's actually in a national park. And there's really nothing else sort of quote-unquote civilized around it. So let me read you just a short section to give a taste of what it's like there in the summer, which is when the fires that we're going to hear about impacted Tassajara. So it's in the middle of the guest season, and actually this is the day after those lightning strikes that started the main threatening wildfire. But the guests don't even know about it yet. Only the staff knows about it. Occasionally a backpacker wanders into Tassajara on foot, but most people arrive via the road. As Colin did the first time, they have plenty of time to wonder, where is this place? Tassajara sits at the road's terminus in a deep notch in the earth rimmed by mountains. On the drive-in, the world's glitter and self-importance gradually fall away. Humility comes naturally when you're standing at the base of so much vertical rock from within Tassajara, or looking down into the valley from a trail in the surrounding wilderness. The first time I entered the coursing quiet of Tassajara, I felt as if I'd landed somewhere that I could truly rest. both out of my usual element and completely within the elements. There is no electricity in the guest cabins. Light is obtained by kerosene lamp. There are no keys. The paths and internal road are earth and gravel. Residents silently greet one another in passing with a small standing bow called a gassho. The basalt and granite walls of the stone rooms, some of the oldest cabins, were pulled from the stream bed 150 years ago. The walls of the founder's hall were formed of clay from Tassajara Road. The roof beams in the kitchen were salvaged from a local stand of pine trees killed by beetles. The wood surfaces in the zendo were naturally finished with damp rags and monk's feet. Wood, dirt, stone, and bear skin. These are the materials Tassajara is made of. Natural, sturdy, porous, and impermanent. The work circle, zendo, and courtyard between the guest dining room and the kitchen constitute the central area of Tassajara. It's harder to say where Tassajara's heart is, to locate it in any one place. It isn't bound to structures, but rather flows through the place like Tassajara Creek. Despite that generously, endlessly renewing source of water, buildings have been lost to fire before at Tassajara. A grand turn-of-the-century sandstone hotel burned to the ground in 1949. The original zendo went up in flames in 1978. The current zendo was meant to be a temporary replacement, but still stands today on the site of the old hotel, across from the courtyard, an outdoor parlor of sorts for guests and residents. At 7 a.m. on Sunday, June 22nd, the courtyard at Tassajara was still quiet. Morning meditation had just ended. A student arranged the cloth napkins for guest breakfast in alphabetical order by the name on the napkin ring. Another student, still wearing the black robes worn in the zendo, raked the gravel steps above the courtyard. A few early rising guests wandered into the morning chill to fetch coffee. The smell of lemon ginger scones pierced the smoke. So, when the fire started, being good Zen students, the residents basically just got to work. They rolled up their sleeves and they began preparing Tassajara to withstand a wildfire passing through it. The guests were taken out pretty much right away, and that was about 46 at that time. And most of the students left in a second evacuation. So a small crew of just over 20 stayed behind to continue these preparations. They ran fire drills and built a rooftop sprinkler system from PVC pipe and garden sprinklers. They called it Dharma Rain. They cleared brush and leaf litter and dug fire line. They prepped with the help of a fire captain who was basically donating his time. He was on vacation technically, but he went down to help them prepare. And they planned to keep a small crew of people at Tassajara really in any case. They never planned to abandon it completely. As I mentioned in the section I read, Tassajara has had visits from wildfire before in 1978 and 1999. These were also very big fires. Actually, in 99 it ended up missing it, but they prepared anyway. And in those instances, the firefighters and the monks, the professionals, came down that road and they really worked together to help prepare Tassajara. And in 2008, most of the firefighters who came down to help Tassajara prepare and pitched in with those efforts, who toured around, agreed that it was a very defensible situation. Due to its location at the bottom of a valley instead of up on a ridge, which is, you know, fire travels very quickly upwards and generally much slower down. Due to its ready source of water in Tassajara Creek, and due to all the work that the residents had done to prepare, they're Zen students, they were not sitting there on their hands waiting for someone to come and do it for them. But the firefighters who were responsible for making the decisions on the fire, really for allocating what they call resources, which are people, and also machines, they were really worried about this road that I mentioned. They didn't share the confidence of those firefighters who came down that road and saw the situation on the ground and said, yeah, this is doable, this is defensible. The firefighters up the road were very nervous, the ones who were making decisions, and they were saying to the residents of Tasajara, please leave, because one road in and out doesn't give us a backup plan. We can't have a plan B when there's only one road in and out. In their language, it's a risk we can't mitigate. So the residents would say, yes, we hear you, we understand that, we're going to stay. Can you please send us some help? And this was the conversation going back and forth. A firefighter who was actually on the ground with them, the one I mentioned who was giving up his vacation, his name is Stuart, and you'll hear about him in one of the other sections I'm going to read. He was so confident that they'd be able to handle the situation that he used to joke with them that he was going to sit around on one of the cabin porches with a cold Coors in his hand and between sips of it, you know, douse the flames while they did the major work. Because they really anticipated the fire to come in, maybe from one side, and kind of creep its way in, and they were so well prepared that they really thought it would be a very manageable situation. So it was kind of a case of hurry up and wait. You know, a lot of alarm in the beginning, a lot of quick energy and work. And then, when is this fire going to come? Because the lightning strikes were in late June, and it took 3 weeks for the fire to actually come to Tasajara's gate. So as I mentioned, during that time, they kept up with all this work, this preparing. Really, it was endless. They kept finding things they could do. And of course, the leaves kept falling, right? And they had to keep raking the leaves up. It's amazing how many leaves actually do fall in the summer. And the community watched. And by the community, I mean those of you here. Probably some of you are following the Sitting with Fire blog that got created in Jamesburg, which is the sort of command central for Tasajara up that dirt road where the paved road and the dirt road meet. There was a blog there that was keeping people updated, and that blog was being read internationally. It's really fascinating, actually. You know, there were hits from Sweden and Australia and, you know, Germany and Japan, all over Africa even, there were some. So Tasajara has a global sangha, and everybody was watching and everybody was wondering, should they stay or should they go? As the situation kind of heated up. And then the situation really heated up. The weather made a sharp change from being, you know, in California we have that coastal fog that regularly comes in. You know, when we left this morning, it was in the 50s or low 60s or something. It's very cool, right? And that was keeping the fire in check. And the weather was going to get really, really hot and really dry, and the wind was going to kick up. And so a red flag alert was issued by the National Weather Service. All of the firefighters who were down there doing prep took off. And Stuart, this CAL FIRE captain who was down there helping, looked around and took in what he knew about the weather, took in what he knew about fire from his many years, you know, 20 to something years, maybe almost closer to 30 years of experience. And suddenly he wasn't joking anymore about the cold Coors and dousing the flames. The situation looked very different to him. He understood that they were going to be alone there in really dangerous conditions. So he initiated a complete evacuation of Tasajara. So against this plan they'd always had of keeping a small crew, he said, no, change of plan. We got to get everyone out. So they did do that. But within an hour, five of them would turn around and come back to Tasajara and stay for the fire. So even now when I say that, I get goosebumps thinking about that. I wish I could, you can see a little bit of the road in those pictures, but knowing where they turned around and knowing where Tasajara was and how much road there was, they had to go back down into a very dangerous situation. The moment I heard this, I just got completely hooked. You know, my head just was gripped by, could I have done the same thing? And what is it that made them know that they could do this or made them want to do this? for me, it was a really fascinating turning point. And this is the origin of this book, because I got so fascinated with this moment that I wanted to get inside it and understand it and know it. So I didn't realize exactly how deeply I cared and was hooked until after the fire had passed, when I read an account on the blog of these events I'm telling you about and just burst into tears. It totally caught me by surprise. You know, I had been watching the situation, but I think I had been watching it kind of up here. And it was only when I learned Tassajara was actually okay, you know, with some cuts and scrapes, that the full weight of it registered. So, as I say, it was this moment of turning around, and it was my own moment of feeling such a deep resonance with Tassajara's well-being that drove me to write this book. And I lived with these questions and this story for the next few years as I wrote Fire Monks. And I'll just say a little bit about what my relationship was with Tassajara. I have been practicing since about 2000. And I went, I think, within my first year of practice, my husband had been going to Tassajara for years. And so he said, "You've got to see this place." And I'd heard about it. And so I went there in the summertime, and I did sort of what I think is one of the best ways to be at Tassajara, which is guest practice. So I would go, and we would be students in the morning until midday, and then we would metamorphose into guests, and we would get to lounge around and be on vacation. So it was really great, because we got to be Zen students and be connected to the community, and then we also got to just have some vacation time. So that was the background, and obviously I'm a Zen student. I have a Raksu here that I received in 2006 from my teacher. So obviously there was also the practice component of this story. You know, what was it about practice that shaped how they made their decisions and how they experienced this event? And let's see. One last thing I'll say before I read you the next section is that it's really a book about a Zen community's response to an event, but at the same time very much about the individuals in the book, their unique responses to the event, coming from their own histories, their own karma, their own perspectives, and their own position. You know, whether they were the abbot or the director or just a student or the student fire marshal, or whether they were a firefighter. So one of the next section I'm going to read you, I think, illustrates the kind of multiple perspectives that I tried to include in the book. Many of the sections actually go deeply into, there's a cast of characters in the beginning, and these people are sort of your guides through the story. And in a lot of scenes, you're kind of in one person's experience primarily. But in this scene, we've got lots of sort of individual needs and perspectives kind of clashing up against one another as things really heated up. So this is basically at that point I described where the firefighter who's with them on the ground has changed his mind about the feasibility of them staying. And he's really kind of on his own. Initiated a complete evacuation. And the way he's done that is he's gotten in touch with fire command and said, "We're coming out." So even though he wasn't officially in the line of duty, you know, wasn't wearing the uniform, wasn't official, he initiated this complete evacuation, and air tankers began flying overhead and dropping water on the road so that they could get out safely. So this is a meeting that they have immediately after that happens. Zen students also seem to like to have meetings. And so they can't be stopped even when there are air tankers flying overhead. So the director of Tassajara at that time, his name is David, and he'll be making a request to start a meeting over his radio. And I don't want you to get preoccupied by people's names, so just let it flow through you. You don't really need to keep track of anyone. Stuart is the firefighter I mentioned, and everyone else is a resident of Tassajara.
And Steve Stuckey has been here a couple years ago.
Okay, so Steve is the abbot, one of the abbots at San Francisco Zen Center. And at the time, he came down for the fire, basically. They all heard David's announcement over their radios. The activation group at the flats waiting for their next cue. Shundo and Devin, who'd hiked over the hogback for a look up at the fire at Tassajara Creek. Sorry, for a look at the fire up Tassajara Creek. A skeleton kitchen crew preparing supper. Abbot Steve on his way to the work circle to intercept the three returning from Lime Point on the road. Everyone on the core team, please come to the stone office immediately. Abbot Steve ran into Stuart first, near the gatehouse across from the Zendo. We're leaving, the fire captain told the abbot. He lifted his gaze to the smoke-washed sky above the half-wrapped gatehouse. What? Abbot Steve peered at Stuart through frameless eyeglasses, projecting a naturally confident, cool demeanor despite Stuart's urgency. You don't like this, do you? Stuart said, shifting on his feet. No, I don't. In the weeks since Abbot Steve had arrived at Tassajara, they had been doing everything they could to stay there safely, not to leave it. The abbot knew that the activation drill had not been exemplary. He was there, and he had witnessed the confusion of hoses and rolls, the nervous lack of focus. But that alone couldn't have so drastically shifted Stuart's commitment to staying. What did you see from Lime Point? He asked. The fire is approaching the road, Stuart explained. They're sending air support to keep it clear. We have 10 minutes to get out of here. The fire reaching the road might be a trigger point for the fire service, Abbot Steve thought. But it wasn't a trigger point for him. Just a few days prior, he'd talked with a reporter on the bridge just above where Cabarga Creek spills into Tassajara Creek in the rainy months. Summer guests and residents often relax on its benches made of long, smooth slabs of wood. If the fire comes to visit us at our front steps, the abbot had said as sunlight splashed the head student's cabin behind him, we'll meet it. The sun had set and the moon had risen several times since he'd made that assessment, and it had not changed. This isn't the agreement we had, Stuart, he said. It's not how we make decisions here. A lone cellar's jay squawked on the hill behind the gatehouse, one of the many that usually patrolled Tassajara looking for handouts and crumbs. Or actually, taking them. They don't just look, they take. Most of the wildlife seemed to have cleared out in advance of the fire. Stuart sucked in a breath and turned his gaze in the direction of the hogback, the low ridge where earlier he'd seen fountains of flame spilling down the canyon toward Tassajara. He shifted his weight from side to side and blew out the intake of air, shaking his head. We have to leave, he repeated. Stuart was all motion, but the abbot held his body still, his movements frugal and precise. We have a designated safe retreat, Stuart. We have our sprinklers and pumps to take care of. You yourself said, it's a different fire today than it was yesterday, Stuart interrupted. They're calling for red flag conditions. We're alone here. I've got no backup. We don't have the capacity to do this by ourselves, not in these conditions. And I don't want to be responsible for what could happen. We have to leave. We need to discuss this with the core team, said Abbot Steve, reiterating what David had already told Stuart on the road. The abbot turned back toward the stone office, walking past the small altar where ordinarily incense is offered daily in the work circle. Stuart, incredulous, trailed a few steps behind as they passed the kitchen. On a typical summer day, sounds of pots banging and knives chopping, one meal's cleanup and another's preparation would float from the windows. Now it was quiet. Only one or two people were needed to prepare a simple dinner for the 22 who remained. The reassuring murmur of Tassajara Creek drifted through the windows of the open-air student eating area, where Abbot Steve had sat Tongario, his first practice period at Tassajara. That was before the Zendo burned. He remembered exactly where his seat had been, facing the creek near the door. His legs had felt every kind of pain, throbbing, tingling, cramping, aching, even burning. But he'd sat through it all, watching how the mind tries again and again to refuse to feel what is unpleasant, unwanted. Now simply watching his own response was not an option. According to Stuart, this fire had become a different fire. That was entirely possible. Every fire was different from one moment to the next, just like everything in the universe. Despite their less than perfect activation, Abbot Steve thought they were ready. The words he'd said earlier to the reporter were still true. He didn't feel a change within himself corresponding to Stuart's shift. Stuart had said he didn't want to be responsible for what could happen, but in Abbot Steve's view, that responsibility fell to the core team of decision makers. If they left, as Stuart said they had to, the pumps drawing water into the standpipe system and pushing it through Dharma Rain would run out of fuel. The sprinklers would sputter and stop on the rooftops. The fire would pour into that vacuum. Even the stone kitchen would burn, as the old Zendo had, the fire consuming the cookbooks and the wooden shelves that held them, and warping the steel sinks and hanging steel racks used to cool freshly baked loaves of bread. Everything that could would burn. Abbot Steve was relatively new to his position. At the ceremony installing him as abbot, he'd taken a vow. Having entered this path, I cannot turn aside. His first concern now was for everyone's safety. But his position gave him another responsibility, not lower or higher, but equally present, to tend to the practice and bring forth the teachings of the Buddha. It was responsibility in its broadest sense. To take care of Tassajara included taking care of the creek and forest, the temple buildings, the bodies and minds of every resident and guest. The guardian of the temple, a foot-tall wooden figure with a furrowed brow and a stick balanced behind his bowing hands, had already been taken out to Jamesburg. The remaining residents and their embodiment of practice were the guardians of the temple now. So they go around the room, they have a bit of a powwow, a very short one, and people raise some issues and speak their piece. And then Abbot Steve laid his hands on the fire maps on the countertop. The three-day-away fire, that's what they'd been calling it for almost 3 weeks. Did anyone really know how to predict the movements of a wildfire, he wondered. He sensed the passage of time moving much too slowly for the fire captain, yet too quickly for the group being asked to abandon their temple and home. Later, he described feeling extreme concentration, a deep awareness of the consequences of their decision. Like a diver on a high dive board about to leap into space, knowing that every movement counts, even the movements inside the mind. It was true that they'd agreed to follow Stuart's advice before Abbot Steve arrived at Tassajara, and that conditions had worsened weather-wise. It was true that the heart of Tassajara could not be burned, and buildings did not matter when compared with a human life. But something else was also true. At a question and answer session at Green Gulch Farm after the fire, Abbot Steve would observe, "If you look at Tassajara on the map, and you see only one way in and out, and you don't really know Tassajara, it looks like this is a very dangerous, risky place to be. Sometimes a close, intimate perspective is critical in understanding what to do, and sometimes you need to step back and have a wide view. In fact, having both perspectives is best. Ehe Dogen wrote, put your whole attention into the work, seeing just what the situation calls for. Do not be so absorbed in one aspect of a matter that you fail to see its other aspects. When you wash the rice, see the sand in the rice and the rice in the sand. One aspect of Zen practice is learning not to stick to any fixed view or sense of situation or self. Zen also teaches the cultivation of skillful means, the ability to approach a situation with flexibility and respond appropriately, with an eye toward encouraging awakening in oneself and in others. Abbot Steve looked up from the stack of fire maps. "Okay," he said. "I guess we need to go." He said we need to go, but inside the contours of his own mind, he started plotting how to stay. So I did not want Fire Monks to be a book that only Zen students would read. I wanted the Zen to be folded into the story the way that it folds into a practitioner's life. You know, quietly supporting the everyday. Not a big dramatic show. I thought, you know, there's something very useful happening here. Something very portable, actually. And it isn't just something that a Buddhist can hear. It's something that can be applied to any situation. This practice of allowing, of showing up in the present moment, not turning away from our vulnerability, of accepting that everything changes, of honoring what we know while admitting the vastness of what we do not know. Basically, the wildness of our lives. So in the book that I wrote, the fire actually becomes a metaphor for adversity. The example of the five monks, and actually really the whole community of monks, because this was, you know, when it came down to it, only five were at Tassajara, but many, many hands took care of Tassajara before and after, and many chants took care of Tassajara remotely. So the example is inspiring, though human and imperfect, and I go into that in my book, in that it's a portrait of turning towards the wildfires of our lives with a calm, open, flexible mind, and finding the ready resource of courage in something as simple as awareness, staying present and not flinching from the present moment. And we all possess this. We all possess this. It's not a superhuman or elite quality. The fire was a particularly loud and insistent call to wake up, a very vivid reminder of impermanence. And after its passage, actually, one of the monks, Mako, the one woman who stayed, who I was very grateful there was a woman in my story that I could tell, she said, you know, she really missed the sort of heat and urgency of the fire. Because when the fire was right there, or even when it was not quite right there, but potentially right there, there's a focus that's very natural, right? It's really clear what needs to happen, especially when it's right in front of you. Get a hose, right? It's not complicated. It's real clear. And in most of our lives, there's a lot more muddling through things and not knowing exactly what step we should take or what we should do next. So such decisive action can feel more elusive when we're actually facing what I would call the fires of our own lives. You know, might be divorce, might be a pink slip from your employer, might be a traffic jam on a hot day in a car with no air conditioning. Life is suffering, the Buddha taught. He also taught that the entire world is on fire. All is aflame, he said in his fire sermon. Everything is always changing, always burning, always transforming. So difficulty is a given, but how we relate to it, how we meet it, is not. And that's where practice comes in. We can turn away from the difficult. We can deny it, ignore it, run from it. Or we can turn toward it and meet it, like the residents at Tassajara did. Not knowing how it's going to turn out, not knowing if the decision is right or wrong, quote unquote right or wrong, good or bad, not knowing what kind of fire would actually arrive. They put on their fire gear and they trusted in their wholehearted effort that they would make together. And that's what a fire monk does. So I would argue we can all be fire monks. We are all fire monks in our lives. And I want to leave you with one last segment in the book, and then hopefully there's time for questions. Okay, great. So this is actually the last. I'm gonna read you a little section from the day the fire actually arrives. So, you know, there's a lot of waiting in the book, and but you know, ask Taigen, you know, somehow there's tension that keeps pulling you forward, but the fire, you know, doesn't come till close to the end, and it's really about how they're meeting all of this waiting. You know, before that point. But now it's here. It's actually come. And there are only five of them. And they're looking around going, how are we going to do this? Tassajara is not particularly small when you look at it that way. A wildfire coming and only five people and many buildings. I think it's 40-something buildings when you count them up. And it stretches maybe a half a mile along the creek. So big job. It's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the day after that evacuation and turnaround by five people. Inside the cocoon of the wrapped stone office, David's head ached from the smoke and a restless night spent sleeping on the floor in the office to be near the phone. The two aspirin he'd taken had not kicked in yet. He'd spent the morning on patrol, making sure that nothing had been left vulnerable to floating embers during the previous day's rushed evacuation. Then he'd helped to wrap the office windows and move flammable back porch furniture away from the walls. Every 30 minutes, he'd check the phone inside the office for new fire information. As flames crested the ridges surrounding Tassajara, David had called Jamesburg with an update. Stepping outside now, he saw himself that the fire was not arriving in one discrete front, but in a ring of flame, like an Enso, a circle drawn in one brushstroke that symbolizes enlightenment, inked with fire. Fire was not just descending on Tassajara, he wrote later. It was converging on it. But the five people at Tassajara did not converge, circle up, or even talk about what they should do next. There wasn't a moment when they all stood together as they had in the emergency meeting in the stone office or in the huddle on the road to collectively make a decision. Yet they had to make a decision to either bunker in their safe zone as the fire passed through the valley or make a stand to try to defend Tassajara. Here was another pivotal moment from which so many possible outcomes could spin, the kind of moment that might be held up to the light afterward. If all goes well, it might inspire and amaze. But if something goes badly, it would be the precise moment people would point to saying, here's where they made the wrong choice. Here's where, if they hadn't done X, then Y would never have happened. A moment like the one that five firefighters faced in the fatal Esperanza fire. The five Zen priests at Tassajara were not in the habit of dividing choices into right or wrong, good or bad. They practice seeing everything that happens as part of a continuous and always completely unified stream of events. Each moment flowing like the creek from what came before into what comes next, all of time moving together. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus said that you cannot step in the same river twice. A Zen master might add cheerfully, you cannot step in the same river because there is no river. There is no actual you. The river and you and your stepping are in a dynamic and interrelated state of constant change. Maybe it's the river that steps into you. Maybe there's only stepping, no one to step or thing to step into. In Zen, you can't really make a wrong decision, but you can't make a right decision either. You can only respond, moment to moment, in a way that feels the least harmful and deluded, the most compassionate and true. It's the effort that counts, Suzuki Roshi told whoever came to listen, the sincere commitment to wake up, wherever you are, moment by moment. No one can ask more of you. As a ring of flame looped around Tassajara, David felt a palpable beat of hesitation, a flickering thought that maybe they had gotten themselves in over their heads. But then, as individuals and as a small sangha within the sangha, they acted. They made an effort. They moved toward a river of fire. They didn't so much make a decision as manifest collectively and without words a mind already decided. They didn't need a decision tree or cost-benefit analysis or even a plan. They just got to work, doing something extraordinary with the mind they cultivated in their daily practices and activities. On another day, it might have been a bell that needed ringing, a soup that needed stirring, a broom that needed picking up. At 1 o'clock on the afternoon of July 10th, it happened to be a fire hose. So thank you very much for listening. And I would love to take any questions or comments that you have.
And I just wonder if you might say a little more about the dramatic actual event when when they actually met the fire, and you know, just the battle plan of how they responded, five of them.
They actually did exactly what they were told not to do, which is, you know, their parting words from Stuart on the road were, "Don't get separated." And the first thing they did was kind of scatter, because Tassajara did need attention at all these different places. You know, the bathhouses at one end, the jewel of the bathhouse, the zendos in the middle, and the, you know, student cabins up on the hill, and guest cabins down here. And so they scattered, but they did stay in radio contact. And so while, you know, had they been on a technical fire crew, they would have been breaking one of the basic safety rules. They did what they felt they needed to do, and they stayed in radio contact with each other, and they basically just like we say we intend to do in Zen practice, they met the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, and it went on for 7 hours. Because basically fire comes through, and it's very dramatic. You know, Mako said she'd read about the head of a fire, and she says, "I don't know what I really pictured, but when I saw it, I said, oh yeah, that's the head of a fire, you know." And what ended up happening is, in that section I read, is the fire did just kind of, you know, and Tassajara has cliffs all around it. It's, you know, it's down in this valley. You look straight up at these various peaks. And it just came over all of them at the same time. So, and there's actually a video of it that you can watch. And there's a link on my website to it. It's very short. Mako got her camera and, you know, panned. And you can see it coming in. And that's how the head of the fire came in. But then, as soon as it reached the level of the moisture where Dharma Rain had, they'd been running it constantly, they all described this fire just kind of like, and then slowing, and then very slowly continuing to come down. So, you know, it was really that visual feedback that gave them the sense that they did not have to run into the stone office and take, you know, hold onto their fire shelters and hope that it would pass quickly, that they could actually try to meet it and save the buildings. And they did, you know, they didn't save everything, but, you know, you can see the details in the book, but there were some dramatic things that happened throughout the day, but, you know, I'll say that it all ends well. You know, it's a happy story at the end. Any questions?
Questions, comments, please.
Afterwards, did they say that they knew what each other was doing, or did they, how did they manage that?
Yeah. You know, I had this image when I was talking to them about that kind of thing of Orioki breakfast, that, you know, when you're serving formal Zendo breakfast, Orioki, when you have the nested bowls and the cloths, it's like a ballet, you know, the serving crew, there's no talking between the servers and the people they're serving or between the members of the serving crew. You're like, first of all, there's some forms that you're just embodying, but also there's something about reading each other without words. And these are people that have lived together for years and practiced together for years. Basically, the abbot, you know, the others were all kind of peers, kind of the same peer group. They'd all sort of entered practice around the same time, and they've been practicing for, you know, 7-8 years together by the time this fire comes through. So there's something about that kind of knowing. You know, they know at Tassajara, I'm sure you remember this from your days, you know somebody's footsteps. I'm sure it's true here too, if you sit often here, you kind of know by the way someone enters a room, oh, that's so-and-so that just opened the door and closed it, or that's so-and-so walking behind me in that particular way, or so-and-so sneezing now. So I think, and they basically said there was a kind of like organic, they all just kind of went, and it worked. But without making it sound too magical, they also use their radios, and when things cropped up that required more than one person, which happened several times, then they called for help. So it was both very practical and also this sort of more intangible, harder to measure level of connection that's really strong of people who live and practice together. Yeah.
At the crunch when they were facing the fire.
Yeah.
What were their actions? What did they do to deal with, to counter what they were facing?
You mean
O's, the cloud.
Yeah, okay. I was wondering what level of answer you were looking for. They used fire extinguishers, they used water. Basically, Tassajara, you know, because it's got this long history with wildfire and because it's in the middle of the wilderness, they live with, basically, there's always a fire crew. And, I think to amuse themselves, they put me on the hose crew when I was at Tassajara in the fall of last year for a practice period. It's like, oh, she's going to write about fire. Let's make her put on one of those hot suits and pull the hose, you know. So they have a standpipe system that's in place and hoses and all the gear, this wonderful fire shed with donated, you know, fireproof suits and helmets and backpacks and tools. And they had all of that at their disposal. So a lot of water, and they used both chemical and water fire extinguishers, and they used dirt. There's one instance where Abbot Steve is putting out a fire on some steps to the yurt, which they worked so hard to save and is now replaced by a beautiful new retreat hall. So anything they could to smother it. Yeah. Does that answer your question? Okay. Don?
Well, also, they fueled the pumps, which was one of the big things that they felt like they had to be there for.
That's right. Yeah, if they had left, as I think one of the parts I read about alluded to, they would only run for about 3 to 4 hours. The fuel would only take the pump for 3 to 4 hours worth of operation, and then it would have stopped. So if they'd left when asked to, you know, the fire didn't come in until 1 p.m. the following day. They exited at 6 p.m. the night before. So the sprinklers would have stopped around 11 p.m. at the latest the night before, and it would have been all those hours of no moisture. And because it was so dry, things would have dried out quite quickly. So, you know, all of the people who stayed feel like Dharma Rain. I mean, Colin, one of the residents, you know, there's a funny quote from him in the book. He says, Dharma Rain saved our bacon. that without it, they couldn't have done. Because, yeah, it kept, I mean, they were walking around nice and cool, actually, because there was so much moisture in the air. As hard as that is to believe, you know, you're in the middle of a wildfire and they were actually cool because the creek was running and the moraine was running. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
Are they leaving the sprinkler system up now?
Really good question. Are they leaving the sprinkler system up? No. They took it down because it's not aesthetically pleasing. It's like white PVC pipe, you know, and They took it down, but they're in the process of trying to raise money for a permanent sprinkler system, which is, you know, obviously even better, you know, to actually get copper piping and, you know, do it in a way that it fits the aesthetic of Tassajara and does the job. So, you know, I hope it's not too long before that actually happens, because, you know, the past has a way of kind of receding, you know, and it would be really nice if they didn't have to create it all again with an actual fire threat. So, yeah.
How realistic, or is it a possibility for airlifts out of Tassajara by helicopter? Or?
Apparently, after the Vietnam War, when there were a lot of helicopter pilots who had done some really gnarly flights, it was possible. I heard stories of them picking up someone from, like, in the middle of the creek. The person was on a rock, and somehow they got him into the helicopter. But they, nobody now will do it. They actually tried to sort of line that up ahead of time, because then they could make the argument to the firefighters, right, that, oh, but we do have a way to get people out if we need to. But both because of the smoke, you know, they can't be sure that they're going to be able to fly, because if the smoke is too heavy, you know, then they really just can't risk it. But also, it just, the really, the terrain is so crazy, you know, up and down, really perpendicular, that the helicopters don't want to land. Although I always thought the flats seemed like a reasonable place, and maybe you've seen a chopper land there.
I haven't, but when I was living there, this is almost 30 years ago, there was the helicopter pad, unquote, the so-called helicopter pad, was a little space on top of the hogback,
right,
which is this ridge that goes up, and Suzuki Roshi's buried just near the top of it, and there's a space at the top that's marked off that's maybe a third the size of this room.
Right. And so you're imagining
a quarter of this room. And, you know, so I don't know what helicopter pilot could just land there. But that was supposed to be for evacuations. I know there was a case in the summer once where somebody was poisoned by eating the wrong thing, and they had to evacuate. I think at that time somebody landed a helicopter in the flats, which is a area kind of outside the main part of Tassajara, which is relatively flat.
Yeah. So it's probably another thing to think about for them, if they can clear a better area, you know, to actually have a legitimate, you know, helicopter pad. It would be a good thing for the future. Yeah.
Also, fires create their own wind, and it's ferocious. And that's why, you know, a fire can just, like, you know, blaze across, you know, at very high speed. I think it's like 50 or 60 miles an hour. You can just, like, breeze up a hillside. That's why you can't outrun a fire that's really raging. So helicopters can't deal with that kind of, you know, that kind of turbulence.
Yeah.
It would just, you know, create complete havoc. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
I think it's pretty dubious, I think, to be able to think that you, in the middle of all of that, that you could, you know, land a helicopter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If they were to go on, like, the Stone Hot or just go lay in the creek, did they know that they wouldn't get going?
Well, you could never be guaranteed, but they were actually told, you know, if it just, like, if you're in the stone office and the number was something like if 40% of the roof is on fire, because the roof is actually wood, then it's time to get out of there and jump in the creek, which is right behind the stone office, with your fire shelters. So with these, you know, foil things that are fireproof, and put the shelter over your head, you know, in the creek with a little breathing hole. But, you know, firefighters have still died that way. I mean, it's the safest thing you could do, but it doesn't mean that it couldn't still be a situation where where the heat is just so intense that it actually scorches your breathing passages, and then you asphyxiate. You cannot breathe. That's what happened, you know, in the Man Gulch, famous Man Gulch fire in Montana. The heat, you know, just completely singed the air passageways of these firefighters that were trying to outrun a fire up a very steep hill. And, you know, they lost that run. So the creek was the best bet, but not a guarantee.
Do you have a section in the book has anyone asked the one firefighter that you were saying, his initial plan was to throw beers and then he changed his mind and was like, no, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Has anyone spoken to him about how he was able to change his response?
Yeah, he's actually one of the main characters in the book, because from the very beginning I felt a lot of compassion and empathy for his position. I thought, oh my gosh, all this like authority, all this responsibility, but no authority. No one's listening to you. The abbot's not taking your orders, the monks are not taking, you don't have any ordering power, which is, you know, very unusual for him. He's used to his firefighters better follow an order or they're canned, that's it. So I wanted to include him, and he's absolutely a character in the book. And sometimes he's come to a few events with me, actually, and been available for the Q&A. So his point of view is equally, I think, equally presented.
Right. Because yeah. I wonder if that's a natural tendency for him, that way that he responded, or if that was something unusual.
I don't think it was unusual, because firefighters, they have to make their decisions based on anticipating what the worst case scenario is and make the most cautious decision and evaluate the risks. And so he would, I think, say to you that he did all the things he would normally do and looked at what was in front of him and went, I can't put these people's lives at risk. They're not professionals and this isn't worth it. So, you know, he was weighing things. But they looked at the same situation and saw it differently. So that's what I found so interesting.
Well, given the history of droughts and beetle infestations that are killing trees that dry out, it seems like pretty likely that there will be another Kasahara fire before too long. Mm-hmm. And now there have been two large fires that were successfully defended, so those are going to be seen as precedents. But I guess the question is, how good are the precedents? Was this a rash? This was the decision to stay, a rash decision that worked out well, or was it a prudent decision that worked out well?
Mm-hmm. I think it depends on who you ask. It's funny, when I talk to firefighters, almost invariably the first things out of their mouth is, they were lucky. They were so lucky. And they will always say that. And when I talk to people who, you know, either the people who were there or people very close to the people there, they point to, you know, the skill with which the situation was handled. And if I bring up luck, it's kind of like, well, circumstances and conditions aligned beneficially. You know, they don't really want to point to luck. So I think it really depends on who's talking. But I will say that Mako, who's in the book and who's still at Tassajara, but only for a couple more months, she's been there for like 10 years and she's finally going to move on to new things. She spoke with a new like district ranger in the Los Padres National Forest, and they're sort of making an effort now to, the local fire officials are sort of making more of an effort to make relationships with Tassajara that weren't there. They weren't in place at the time of this story, and that had an impact on how things went. And so those relationships are actually being nourished now, both from Tassajara's end and from the fire management end, the rangers and the fire officials. And Mako said to me she thought that had something to do with, that fire monks had something to do with that, sort of putting Tassajara on the radar, you know, for them. So I don't know how they feel about it, but I think they're more aware now, you know, oh, maybe these people do know what they're doing, or maybe we should actually, you know, trust them and work as a partner with them.
Did any of the people who continued to evacuate regret not going back with the fire?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. Yes. You know, one of the painful parts of this story, both people's experience of it and my writing of it, was that people didn't get to be, there was an inside outside, a perception of inside and outside. There was a group of 20 or so who'd been preparing, right, and then there were only 5 who stayed. So there were those who did go out that would have liked to have been there, and there were those who went out who felt that it was a mistake for those 5 to go back, and that it had been like a, you know, a pulling apart of the community when they should have all stayed together and taken care of each other as a whole. So it was a difficult sort of event, particularly for some individuals who wanted to be there and couldn't, or didn't want to be there and wanted everyone else out of there. And then when I started to work on the book, it was like, oh, you want me to talk about that? You know, you want me to dig up that stuff? And there was a lot of pain still there. I didn't read that section, but, you know, in particular, one of the individuals was the student fire marshal. And so that means he's just, you know, he's not a firefighter. He's a student who's been given this job of being fire marshal. So he leads the drills and he sort of checks all the gear and makes sure they have everything they need. And he finds himself in the middle of this crazy situation, this wildfire. And he makes the decision to go out. He could have gone back with that group of five because of his position. And he's the only one who said, no, not me, I'm going out. And I really had to persist with him to get him to tell me his story, because there was a lot of pain there. But I felt that it was so important to show that that was also a response to this, and that it was equally appropriate, you know. And actually, the abbot was very grateful that he could stand there and say, no, not me, I'm going out. So there was difficulty, and it's something that I tried to bring into the story as well. The difficulties within this community, this tight-knit community around this event.
But as you say that, I didn't realize that only those five kind of had the authority.
Authority, right. Well, it was sort of, in some ways it was self-appointed authority. But they were all priests, they were all senior students, and they were all senior staff. And they had all been involved in, I think I alluded to the core team. They had been what they called the core team. They'd been getting all the fire information, and they'd been having meetings like several times a day. So it was kind of, it wasn't like out of the blue, put it that way. They were already in a position of deciding. But there were those who had that same feeling, like, hey, who? Why did you get to it, not me? How are we doing on time?
Well, we're past our usual time. I think maybe what we'll do, and it's so great to have you here to talk about this, so we will have tea and cookies as usual, and there are books for sale in the back, and with this many people, I guess people can come back and have Colleen sign them. Adam, maybe you can bring tea and cookies for Colleen.
sure.
And but I want to say a little bit more just about Tassajara, because it's hard to understand what Tassajara is if you haven't been there.
Yeah.
You mentioned the 14-mile dirt road. It's not just that it's windy and that there are there are sheer cliffs off one side. It's that it's you know, I remember there were guys and gals who were the did the town trip, who were good at getting in and out in like less than an hour. But it really, to drive that road carefully takes an hour and a half. And it's always felt to me like entering some different time dimension.
Yeah.
Being in Tassajara, it's just very different. And when you're there, and you're there for 3 months, if you're doing a practice period, or even in the summer and guest season, it's a different kind of space. All the things you said about, you know, no email, no electricity. I mean, now there's a little bit of electricity in a few places, but it's just, it's hard to explain how remote it is, not just physically, but psychically.
Yeah.
So it's a really special place, and they're just now this month celebrating the 50th anniversary of San Francisco Zen Center. Tassajara started as a monastery in 67, and many, many, many people who are now, as you say, all over the world have gone and done practice periods, and spent sometimes years. So Tassajara is a very important place. So So for Steve, you know, as abbot, Steve was here a couple of years ago. Some of you were here when he was here. His responsibility was not just to the buildings, but huge.
That whole community, yeah. And I think that's what we all know, people who've been there, but that the fire community couldn't be expected to see. You know, they just didn't have, you know, to them it's buildings. Mm-hmm. Replaceable. And in fact, yes, replaceable. Like, that argument came up a lot. The heart of Tassajara can't really be burned, right? It isn't the buildings. But there's something about, I'm sure when you go, I mean, people will point out to me, oh, Suzuki Roshi placed that stone. You know, there's his rock, his stonework is around. And, you know, things like that. Or Steve is constantly saying, oh, I built that thing there. Or, you know, there's like bits and pieces of sort of American Zen and all the teachers and all the people that have passed through there. And you really do feel that when you're there.
Yeah.
And I did bring... I think back in my bag back there, I have a few brochures. I think I have like four. If somebody wants to grab a brochure for the guest season, which is still going on until September 10th.
Yeah, so a good way to go there, if you haven't been there and would like to, is during the summer guest season. You can go for, you know, a limited period and help out, and but also partake of the zazen and the practice there.
Yeah.